and a few wintry showers will continue in the extreme north and west, but a quieter day for most, particularly in comparison to recent events. Now, as skies clear through Saturday night, expect a hard frost, another dry start to the day on Sunday before further rain spreads in from the west, and this time the rain will be heavier and the winds stronger. There's a little bit of uncertainty about the timing of this weather front on Sunday, but at the moment it looks as though it's not going to arrive till later on in the day, so the majority of us will enjoy another bright, but more importantly, another quiet day. That's your weather.
Thank you, Louise. Now on Radio 4, Will Adamsdale reads a fourth extract from The Telling Room.
I told Ambrosio about this book of mine, or book of his. He understood, of course, what had delivered me here in the first place, his cheese, and what had brought me back. His telling of a slow food fable gone so awry that murder hung in the balance. I suspect he was flattered by my interest. I asked him about everything during our first weeks in Guzman, but not as a journalist, as an interested party, as a would-be participant. Then, Ambrosio did a most extraordinary thing. He appeared at the house one morning and asked me to hold out my hand. "Para ti, Michael," he said, laying a key on my hand. The key to his telling room. "There is a full burong of wine on the table," he said. "You'll write our book there." He was going to make me the 81st citizen of an 80-person village, and I would tell his story to the world. I asked him what he had done in the aftermath of the betrayal. For years, he said to me, he had planned Julian's death, killing him every single night. He sat with me and told me now of the spring and the dark time after the death of his cheese, of nights spent atop Mont Virgo, drinking and cursing, psyching himself up to murder. Ambrosio Molinos was like a jilted lover, but his lamenting could bring nothing back now. He spat in the wind. It was the hour just before dawn, and he was resolved. He stopped at his own house on the way to kill Julian, to say goodbye. He could hear the deep breathing of his children as they slept, and in the dim light, he could see the certificates and medals hung over the desk, all won by his family's cheese. Then he pushed open the door of his 12-year-old daughter's room and saw her sleeping, her eyes tracking beneath her lids in some dream that had nothing to do with cheese or rage. He stood there, gazing at her, and unresolved himself. Then he went to see a lawyer in Madrid. In this man's cocoon of an office, decorated with oriental rugs and pastoral paintings, Ambrosio told his story and listened intently for the possibility of justice. The law of the land would weigh the matter of Julian's deception, said the attorney, but hearing the events as Ambrosio unfolded them, he believed that Ambrosio had a winnable case. But he warned, justice is a slow-moving process. When Ambrosio left, he was inflated with the slightest hope. He'd been offered an alternative ending to his story, legal revenge. The lawyer was going to cost money, so Ambrosio took to the road in his truck, hauling grain to Germany, cocoa to Holland, juices to Austria. Driving a truck suited him just fine. "It's like a research grant to study other cultures," he would tell friends. He told me a story about arriving at a place, a castle factory somewhere in Germany, and a small man, a dwarf, magically appearing before him, allowing him through the gates to pick up his load of Pringles, potato chips. He was taken to a bar where he spoke nothing but Spanish and was met with nothing but German, and yet never, he said, had he felt such a connection as that day with the dwarf and his brethren. They understood each other. Later, when I did some investigation into the origin of Pringles, I couldn't find a German castle factory that belonged to the Pringle family. The inventor was a Latvian from Ohio. They were made by Procter & Gamble. Had Ambrosio lied? No, I don't believe so. Lie is such an incendiary word for a storyteller. They have to make their story pleasing. The downside of roaming all that open road was that Ambrosio had to contend with memories of his lost cheese and the loss of his oldest, closest friend. The road does this to a person, impels him backward into memory as he hurtles forward, the episodes of a life flickering on the horizon. He wondered if happiness might ever be possible again. He came back to his homeland and drew his head down, waiting for some sort of retribution and justice. I was there when the court cases were in progress, but I never was privy to the details. I never asked to speak with Ambrosio's lawyer because, well, something stopped me short. It was the same thing that stopped me going to Julian. Something I knew I had to do and filled me with dread. Why? I was used to checking off sources, asking tough questions. Here, Ambrosio was my only source, and for some reason, I kept it that way. Maybe I didn't want to violate the trust we had established, as it might suggest I didn't take him at his word. But one Sunday, I arranged to visit the cheese factory. I felt as if I was committing my own betrayal of Ambrosio. A man approached, squinting, hand outstretched. This was Jose, the alleged turncoat, the one man who stayed behind when Ambrosio left the factory with all of his employees behind him. He had agreed to see us, despite the fact that the factory was closed for the weekend. "Who founded this business?" I said, as he started to give us the tour. I was playing the calculating naive. "Ambrosio Molinos," he said, with no hint of malice. He was in his 30s when he started, and I was very young, 19 when I began here. It soon became clear that Jose had no filter, would say almost anything. He told us that Harrods had carried, then recently dropped, the cheese. When I asked him if he recalled the first time he tasted the cheese, he said, "I didn't like it at all. It has a very strong taste. It's a radical cheese. It tastes like the land here." Eventually, he led us to the back of the warehouse, where we found wooden pallets piled high with distinctive white and gold tins of cheese. I could almost see Ambrosio here, counting canisters of sheep milk or checking on the rennet. At the end of the tour, Jose took us into the original cheese factory next door. From the wine cellar, he found a red wine and poured us a glass before opening a tin of Paramo de Guzman. He worked a can opener till the lid came free. Inside, bathed in olive oil, were two wedges of rich amber color. My first taste. I took a half-hearted bite. I'll admit it. It was good cheese. But had I tasted centuries of love and care as designed by the Molinos family? No, I had not. I faked enthusiasm pretty well, bought a couple of tins, and thanked Jose for his time. With that ersatz cheese stashed in the trunk, I left, wondering what the original cheese might taste like. Arriving home one night, intoxicated by a day of intermittent wine and story consumption with Ambrosio and his fellows, I found my wife, Sarah, on the roof patio, enjoying the cool air. She let me gush about the day, and then cleared her throat as if to announce something important. She put her hand on mine. "I'm worried," she said. "Worried? About your book. Are you getting anywhere with it?" "Of course," I said, a little drunk. "I'm getting all over the place with it." "But aren't you writing a book about Ambrosio's cheese?" "Yes," I said, palms up, in messianic pose. "Yet you aren't asking any questions about the cheese because you seem afraid to hurt his feelings." Obviously, she'd been waiting a long time to spring this, giving me the full benefit of the doubt, quietly gauging the material I'd accumulated. We now only had 6 weeks left until we returned to our American life, and I couldn't have said much more about the cheese then than when we first arrived 5 months before. "I mean this in the kindest way," she said, "but you seem a little, I don't know, emasculated by Ambrosio?" "What do you mean exactly?" I said. "And how is that kindly?" "Look, I think you just need to level with him and start asking more questions." "This book is much bigger than a piece of cheese," I said, with a last truculent exhalation. "No," she said, "it's the exact same size." That night, I lay awake, thinking about what she'd said. Maybe the reason I couldn't move forward on my book was that I'd come here to move backward in time. As a journalist, you are the ultimate observer. Later, after you wrote your story about other people's stories, the reaction was never predictable. Sometimes you ended up friends, sometimes you never heard another word. Every once in a while, you were threatened with a lawsuit. Perhaps this was my unconscious hedge with Ambrosio then. If I wasn't a journalist, we would never have to be anything but friends. Our summer was vanishing. We began our countdown, even as my page count eked out at the table in the telling room, slowed to a dribble, and then started running backward with some ruthless self-editing. 67 hard-won pages rapidly became 48. We made last dinners and visits to the people in the town who had all befriended us. Near the end of our stay, in the first days of September, Ambrosio invited us to his bodega for a merienda. He informed us that he was also gathering some friends, which added a hint of uncharacteristic formality. What friends, and for what occasion? When Sarah and I arrived, towing Leo in his Real Madrid jersey and May in a pretty red dress and hat, we found a coven of Ambrosio's best mates, all of them in various states of inebriation. Amigos! Ambrosio boomed, drawing out the word, singing it. He introduced the men at the table, many of whom I'd met. Ambrosio Sr. was there too, working the purong when he wasn't slumped asleep with his head on the table. We were greeted like family ourselves, offered a place at the table. Then I felt a meaty paw grip my shoulder and turned to meet Ambrosio's gaze. Michael, he said. Come, I've something for you. I followed him to a dark corner of the cave and saw he had there a white tin with black lettering, that of the original cheese known as Páramo de Guzmán. He took a can opener to it, punctured the seal, and cranked the metal to a jagged edge, peeling back the top. Then he stared down at the wonder he held in his hands. It was his offering, the last tin of his cheese he would ever open, more than a decade old, and he pushed it with a finger in a sort of methodical way. The cheese, the stunning, glorious, mind-blowing cheese, redounded in its soft amber glow. Had he planned this as our goodbye present? Given the enormity of the moment, the last tin of the original cheese opened, I'd say what followed verged on sacrilege. Everyone at the table ignored Ambrosio. Or perhaps it was very Castilian to downplay it all. He pulled out his pocket knife and jabbed one wedge of the cheese. He carried it through the air and pinioned it on a plate, then began slicing it carefully. I couldn't help but watch in awe, imagining those wedges as emblems of a lost purity. Ambrosio offered it to us first. I took a piece, then Sarah took one, our eyes meeting briefly, and together we slid them into our mouths. Yes, this was really happening. How do you describe a moment for which you've waited a small eternity? Wow. Wow. Wow, I repeated, as Ambrosio watched and grinned, saying nothing. The others grabbed their wedges from the plate without comment, carrying on talking and drinking, not once remarking on what they ate. Perhaps the event was only significant for us. Maybe we'd made the cheese mythic, or I had, and Ambrosio had gone right along with me. Meanwhile, the men in the room took the cheese for what it was. Cheese. What did it taste like? I'd like to pretend it tasted like love or history or God, that its molecules reshaped my own, but you know, it tasted like really good cheese. The children cooed and squawked. We were bursting with gratitude. The men popped the rest of the cheese in their greedy mouths, and that was it. Páramo de Guzmán was gone forever.
Will Adamsdale was reading from The Telling Room by Michael Patanetti. The book is abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill, and it's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. BBC Radio 4. Now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today Friday the 10th of January. There are warnings of gales in German Bight, Shannon, Rockall, Bailey and southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. New low expected southeast Iceland 985 by 1800 Friday. Low Denmark 982 moving away eastwards. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Southwest Viking. Northwesterly 5, backing westerly or southwesterly 5 or 6. Showers, rain later, moderate or good. Northeast Viking, north Utsira. Variable 4, showers, good. South Utsira, northwesterly, backing southwesterly 5, occasionally 6 in south, showers, good. 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger,